It's very difficult to actually understand and integrate knowledge if you just read for 10 hours and then only think about it or use it for just 1 hour.
Welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm Ludvig Sundström.
And I'm Mikael Syding.
Hi and welcome. You are listening to Future Skills with Syding and Sundström, and this is the second part of our recent Q&A session. The first part was published as episode number 38 on the 4th of November. In part one, we talked about various aspects of planning your career, as well as employing processes versus setting goals. Today, in part two, we focus more on personal development issues like perseverance, sacrifice, motivation, learning, struggles, and discipline, but also about how to verify and integrate what you learn. As always, it's Alexander Martin that edits and enhances Future Skills Soundscape. This question is from Mr. Christian Duberød, and he wants to know how to draw the distinction between perseverance and bullheadedness. How do you know when to quit? This is a question of grit and stubbornness. And the only thing I can say is to demand increasingly stronger evidence for whatever it is you're pursuing the longer time it gets. Because if you keep upping the ante in terms of the evidence you need to continue, then sooner or later you will not be allowed to continue for yourself. So rather than setting an absolute limit from the get-go in terms of one versus the other, you demand more and more from the one side to continue. Personally, I've had short positions on the market and the car company Tesla, and even though I still had the same strong case for both positions as time went by, I eventually stopped the positions since I couldn't get better and better reasons to continue. Here are a couple of questions from Albin Lundberg, and he wants to know a website you visit often. And for me, it's Zero Hedge, it's goldprice.org, but perhaps even more, I visit kurzweilai.net and, I'm not sure about the ending there, as well as singularityhub.com to learn about new technologies. How about you, Ludwig?
I spend a lot of time on Wikipedia and Wikiquotes. Those are probably the two biggest ones.
All right. And then he wants to know about the hardest decision you ever had to make. I would say it's cutting my big market short position that I held for several years and lost a lot of money on. That took some mental discipline to finally end.
Well, for me, so far, probably that I didn't get a job immediately after university. That was very hard.
Number three, what have you had to give up to get where you are today? And for me, it's time. I've spent a lot of time in the finance industry, and sure, it gave me some riches, but I've lost a lot of time.
I think that's true of everything. Everything is opportunity cost, right?
Yeah. What motivates you? And for me, it's understanding things. I want to understand nature, the world, the universe, people around me, and not least understand myself.
Yeah, I think it's about the same. I have a pretty strong drive to just learn things and be quite curious about how the world seems to work.
All right. And then what was the biggest factor that helped you being successful other than yourself? I can only say like colleagues and maybe my parents. I'm not sure if I have anything really tangible, but I think in a very distinct way, a couple of colleagues were instrumental in headhunting me from one job to another. And that's what made a whole world of difference for my career and personal development.
Next question is from Dylan Chan. He has two questions. The first one is how to distinguish between fake and surface knowledge versus actual knowledge. Basically, how do you know that you're actually learning something? And then the second question, or like follow-up to that, is how do you integrate these different ideas and mental models into your head so that you take them from being abstract models into your daily thinking process? I think that the way to know that you're learning something is to, I mean, you it just pops up into your head and you can use it. You feel that you understand it. That is the first one. When you have an idea and then you just go about your day and then you can see how it works in some aspect of reality. Even if you can't do that, that is the best one, of course. And you can use it in some practical way and see results. And if you can't do that, then you can talk to people who do have the knowledge, who are reliable in that field. And if you can have a conversation with them and understand what they're saying or ask them, or they can somehow validate your understanding of it, then it still might be surface knowledge, but at least you have understood the thing.
Yeah, the issue of fake news has always been extremely important in the history of mankind. It stems all the way back from the creation of the big religions, for example. Talk about fake news and hard to distinguish between reality and fake news. And these days we talk about fake news because of the internet. And how do you know if a Wikipedia article is actually the truth or not? And I would go more or less the same route as you did. One, can you use them? Well, you will know if gravity works if something you drop falls to the ground. Then you can see it for yourself. But it's not always that easy. And the second, you talk about maybe trying to find somebody that is reliable and know whatever it is you want to verify. But you could also just try to triangulate and integrate. So you already know a lot of things. If somebody says this word, it means this and that. If you check your own list of words that you know what they mean, then you can see if there are common parts of the words, and you can find out yourself if it's plausible. So you can use knowledge you already have in various fields and see if whatever new news, if it fits into the entire picture. So triangulation, actual use, and maybe talk to somebody.
And then the second part of the question is, how do you how do you integrate these ideas into your thinking, or rather balance it? And I mean, the real question is, how much can you read in a book and then apply? If you take, for example, say that you're reading 10 hours per day and then you apply it, I don't know, not at all or 1 hour per day, that's like a pretty big very big difference, right?
The ratio between pure intellectual learning and actual doing should be at least closer to a factor 2 than a factor 10. I think it's very difficult to actually understand and integrate knowledge if you just read for 10 hours and then only think about it or use it for just 1 hour.
There's a great saying by Napoleon that I really like. He said that the base must equal the height, like a triangle. And what he's saying is that, you know, you can sit around and read all day if you already have a very, very broad base. But you have to acquire that broad base. Otherwise, you know, you can't build the triangle high.
It's not really practical to just read for 1 hour and then do for a full hour. I think it's difficult. Depends on what you call doing. Maybe you could use clay to model whatever it is you're studying, or you could draw. And that's different from just reading. So maybe in that respect, one-to-one is something to strive for. I'm not entirely sure. It shouldn't be just reading for weeks on end without doing something.
I think there are four big factors that have to do with how well you can integrate complex and abstract ideas into your thinking. And I think these four are that you have a strong goal, that you have an urgent problem, that you're curious, and that you have a talent for synthesis. And I think you should consider how you rank across these four factors. So you have a goal, you have a problem, you have a curiosity, and you have synthesis. And the more you have on each, the more information you can take in. I mean, if you want to have a good example, you could take someone if you have a massive health problem and you know you're going to die in 6 months, it's not going to be hard for you to read up on really boring abstract papers about the disease. But as you go about your normal day, you probably wouldn't you wouldn't have a strong enough problem to care about it. So your brain wouldn't filter out the information and make that abstract process information concrete in some way, because your pattern recognition just won't pluck up the information.
Yeah, so it's really a three-pronged approach here. First, you have to establish a purpose or a why, some kind of a motivation. Then you study it. And third, you integrate it by actually using it. And using it could be modeling it in clay, or telling it to somebody, or drawing it.
Okay, next question is from Kristina Stenberg.
Should I pay off the mortgage loan, or should I set away a savings plan for my daughter? Since Kristina is Swedish, I I recommend the book Investeringsguiden that she can look up. It's right. She's right in the target group for that that book. It tells you exactly what kind of balance to strike between saving and investing and mortgages and stuff like that. Just to give one concrete answer, at least, I think she's already on the right track. She should set aside some kind of a savings account, because it's good to keep separate tracks here, because it's very easy to commingle things otherwise. And some kind of a mortgage on a house is probably reasonable in most cases. They're pretty cheap, and the state supports mortgages, and there is almost no way that she will be kicked out on the street. So therefore, I would say put away monthly savings for your kid. And that is despite me being quite negative to the stock market. But I don't think Christina is supposed to be trying to time the market. She will be saving for her kid for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So start some kind of a monthly saving, but don't put it all in at once if you happen to have some kind of a nest egg already.
The next question is from Erik Åhman, and he's asking, what kind of trend do you think is most overrated at this moment? And secondly, what are your best tips to avoid following these overrated trends? And I think, first of all, I guess he's asking about financial trends. This is not really my strong side. I'm not very good at spotting trends until someone shows them to me. Then I'm very good at analyzing them, but I'm not so good at noticing them before they come up.
Yeah, supposing he's talking about financials, I think dividend investing is one of those trends. People are talking about just buying companies that have a high dividend ratio, and that's just plain stupid. It's completely disregarding any kind of analysis of what the company is about or how they are doing. At least if you do it the wrong way and just focus on dividends, and there are some people who do that. So if you don't know what you're doing, you should not be a dividend investor. And second, also within financials, I think stocks in general, investing in the stock market, because everybody's doing it. There's even a term for it, TINA, there is no alternative, which kind of tells you right away that this is a trend that is peaking and probably about to soon be subject of mean reversion. And within the sector of the stock market, it's small research-based, for example, biotech companies. That's also an extremely strong and dangerous trend, I would say. The sector is definitely overvalued. He's also asking how to avoid being caught up in trends like this. Do you have any view, Ludwig?
I think it's a really good idea to try to know people, to have a broad network and know people from different fields. And then you talk to them and ask them questions about these sort of things. Ask them what they're seeing and so forth. And then the other thing is having good sources of information, and then not listening to the same source of information or reading the same source of information too long. I mean, of course you can. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's important to also switch, to see the difference, to see another point of view.
I think if something feels self-evident or just like water to a fish, then you probably should try to question it, which is, of course, very difficult, because it's hard to even notice things that are all around you. But one way is if you notice that several of your friends are starting to talk about the same thing, like, have you invested in this stock? Everybody is buying it. Then you're probably at the tail end of that trend and should avoid it. Another more concrete way of looking for trends is use Google Trends and search for the term and see what the chart looks like. If the interest in a certain word or phrase has gone up by a lot lately, then that might indicate also that the trend has gone on too far. But maybe throw in some kind of a time factor as well. If it's gone up quickly in just, let's say, a month, depending on what kind of a trend it is, then you might be early. So remember that Google Trends charts, they always go to 100. So they can always keep going up. And many trends last for years. Let's take the stock market. I mean, it's been going up for 10 years. So even if Google Trends would have shown a high interest 8 years ago, there were still 8 years left on the trend. So it's not easy. There is no silver bullet to identifying when a trend has gone on too long.
Okay. Next question. This one is also one for you, Mikael. Finance question. In terms of, in times of a, this is from Henrik Nordin, and he's asking, in times of a bear market in bonds, does it still make sense to park some money in short-term corporate bonds?
To start with, there are no free lunches. So no matter what I say here, you can't really expect to just invest or stay away from investing in corporate bonds and think that that would be a good thing. And here's here's the deal. Some corporate bonds will default. Some will go to zero and some will just pay out half of what they're supposed to pay out. The risk is higher in corporate bonds than in other bonds. And it's higher in this sector now than maybe a couple of years ago, since they are priced higher. But still, just like Howard Marks says, it's high risk if it's priced accordingly that can give you a good return. So I still think it makes sense, but not you can't just point and shoot at just any corporate bond. But I still definitely think if you do the research in the right way, there are still good corporate bonds for your diversified portfolio.
The next question is from Daniel Chalmer, and he's asking us, have you ever talked about NLP in your podcast? And no, I mean, we haven't, but I think it's been discussed. But to be clear, NLP stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. And this is it's a very vague thing. It's like a niche in self-development, I guess. But the real underlying thing, the kernel of truth, so to speak, is that can words change how you think or what you do? And of course, words can change how you think. It's how you think. You think in terms of words. I mean, you think in terms of pictures too, but when you're thinking or writing or philosophizing or whatever you're doing, you need to use some sort of words to have a monologue with yourself. So of course, if you can change the words, it will have a difference. But then how big is the difference? And how do you quantify it and so forth? That's up for discussion, I think.
Exactly. I mean, there is a lot of theory regarding how we humans became humans with all our ideas. And the thinking is that once we developed language, we started to think in different ways as well. And maybe even that was what made us conscious, since we got the tools to talk about ourselves. But to go from there to saying that you can actually manage and govern and steer your own personality by using other words than you otherwise might. That's quite a big step.
It's this extreme overconfidence in one thing.
So actually, if you look up NLP, it says this is one of the best examples of pseudoscience. So NLP is actually used as an example of pseudoscience. So that is something that you shouldn't trust.
I think you can draw a funny parallel to finance. This is kind of it's not a perfect parallel, but I think it's similar that you can, when you're over-relying on one thing instead of having a bigger picture using many different tools, then it's like it's some guy who gets into personal development and it's like, I'm going to change my life with this one super magic thing, the NLP. Or someone who gets into finance, like, I'm going to use this secret pattern with technical analysis and think 5 years ahead with this one thing. And it doesn't work. It's more complex than that.
That's a good parallel, definitely. So it probably has some kind of use and it's worth keeping in mind, but not letting it govern your entire way of being. It's no silver bullet that either. All right, Henrik Nilsson, he wants to know how our podcasts have impacted our lives, what doors and possibilities it has opened. So Ludwig, what do you think?
By far the most important is to have a creative medium and to meet people, to build a bigger network and meet interesting people and talk to them. Smart people whose books I've read and so forth. That's definitely done a lot for my intellectual development. And I think that looking back in maybe 5 or 10 years, I think it's going to be something that we look back on and be happy about and not regret.
For my part, I think most of all, having these podcasts have created artificial boundaries to my life, and that has forced me, end quotes, to sharpen my thinking. So this means that my daily habits and communicative skills have had to develop in order to be useful tools for podcasting. That's my main benefit from this. But then also I've met interesting people, people that are close to becoming close friends or even business partners, even though I would say nothing in totally tangible has materialized yet, but quite a few things are close to becoming real. So far it's mainly been about personal development for me.
Let's take this question from Nuik Lee, and he's asking, how do you best improve self-discipline? And he's asking this coming from having listened to our interview with Eric Townsend, where Eric Townsend said that building discipline is one of the most important things for continuous self-development or self-education. Mikael?
I'm not working on it consciously, so I'm just really trying to get things done. I think maybe I developed my willpower and my discipline early on when I was struggling with my computer between the age of 10 and 15, mainly. So those 5 years is what really gave me discipline and willpower. And since then, I haven't worked consciously on it. So sometimes I do Pomodoros just to create some kind of a limit and motivation, but usually I just have a list of things that are processes that are ongoing, and I just engage with those processes as much as I need and have to for the moment. So I'm not really the right person to ask about this.
Let's go to this next question from Levi Mortensen.
So he's asking about our greatest weaknesses, and I can start. I think that my main problem is that I don't claim my own place in the world. In a very tangible and physical way, I don't walk in straight lines on a sidewalk. And I've talked about this in the podcast before. It may sound silly, but the thing is that it doesn't matter how much eye contact I take, or if I swerve sometimes and sometimes not. It always ends up with me a little bit annoyed and bumping into other people. And for me, that's not really a problem, not physically, because I'm usually the bigger guy. But people get annoyed, even though they bump into me exactly as much as I do. And this is also transferable more in a cognitive or a psychological way to the rest of my life. I'm always careful and attentive to other people's feelings even more than I am regarding my own. So my main drawback is that I am too sensitive and caring about others as opposed to myself.
Well, it's always difficult to know your own weaknesses. It's always easier to know someone else's.
Enrico Schiattarella asks, it's for me mainly, what were the hardest parts of my job as a portfolio manager at Futuris, and what have I learned from keeping a dog? And I would say that the challenges with running a fund was during the startup process that we were subscale and not making a profit, and not knowing if the company would survive after I would actually quit my previous career. That can be take a psychological toll. During the scale-up process, a lot of energy went into selling to new clients without success. And I'm not a salesman, definitely not. I don't feel comfortable. And when I do it and meet hundreds of potential clients and don't even sell for $1, then that's also a psychological toll on me. And one of the actual challenges was that it seemed clients were always demanding one or two more years of track record. So I just kept wasting time waiting for Godot without really being in control of the process. And then finally, when it comes to dealing with specific market events, the hard thing is that no situation is the same. You can never be certain if a decision was right or not. And during those times, you're always under pressure, always just one decision away from a mental breakdown, since you buy something and then maybe it goes down in price and you don't really know whether to sell and be prudent or stick it out and wait for it to go up. And then once you make the decision, then typically the price of the instrument goes the opposite direction, and then you feel like a fool for bailing, and it just keeps going like that sometimes. And it's it's very frustrating. You feel the pressure from wanting to do good by your clients, and also from wanting to be smart and in control when you really know you're not. So the job is it's psychological nightmare almost all the time. And yeah, and regarding the dog, it's been more time consuming and more work than I thought. And it's one thing having one dog, but since my girlfriend introduced a second dog, sometimes I have to walk both of them at the same time. And there is no way I can describe how much more of a hassle two dogs are than just one. One you can control, but if you have two in one leash each, they just keep stopping and walking and pooping and peeing. And I just feel like a bad person having to pull them by their necks to make them walk more or less at the same time. So I feel like a bad person all the time, even though I spend like 3 hours walking them every day. There are so many upsides to having a dog as well. I have to get out 3 times a day at least, which means I get some walking done. I get time listening to podcasts. I get to see the sun, whether I like it or not, which is extremely good for your health. It keeps my circadian clock in rhythm. So those are some of the absolute super upsides that I've gotten for free that I really wasn't expecting. I more or less just expected a nice and cute friend that would be there all the time. That was all the questions we had time for today. Remember to subscribe to our newsletter for important updates and bonuses that we include from time to time. And please take 1 minute from your busy day to rate us on iTunes. It's a small click for you, but crucial, really, for growing that clique of Future Skills listeners.
Thanks for listening, and goodbye.